This is the workshop on parenting teens. My name is Stan Corley. I've had the privilege of working as a family physician for 35 years now in Oklahoma City. So I've learned a lot from families I've been involved with. And I have three sons. My oldest will turn 30 in May. My middle just turned 28, and my youngest will turn 23 in 2 weeks. So I'm past the teen years. I need to quote from Jack Humphreys. Jack is Kirk Humphreys, Kent Humphreys' dad. And I remember hearing him at a conference a number of years ago. He's gone now. He's dead. But he said, when I was a young man, I had six theories for raising children and no kids. So now I have six kids and no theories. So when I was younger, I watched parents and thought I knew a whole lot and I could do it a lot better than they could. And now that I'm on the other end of that, I don't feel like much of an expert. I'm still very much a learner at this point. So as far as having a tried and true cookbook guaranteed formula for you, I don't have it. We'll talk about some principles, but no guarantees. So just so you know that, that's where we're starting from. So let me pray for us, and then we'll go through some thoughts, all right? Heavenly Father, thank you that you've given us the privilege to encourage each other, to look into your word, and do our best to be wise men and apply what we see in your word in the lives of our own homes and our children, and to launch them as best we can. God, we do pray that you would work among us. You know that I've talked to you months ago about these guys who are here, and you put together information that would meet the needs of their hearts. So I trust that's what you'll do in these few minutes. We commit this time to you in Jesus' name. Amen. As far as format, what I'm planning on doing, the first part, I'll be talking through some information and basically just navigating around one principle. So that's what we're going to try to do, just work on one principle, and then the latter part is largely a smorgasbord of tips and trials. My younger brother, Stuart, was slated to do this workshop with me, and his wife got sick yesterday with the flu kind of thing, so he just couldn't come. So I checked with him, and if I need a lifeline, I can call him, so we might bring him in by phone to join us when we're doing questions and answers. Part of the reason for that is I raised boys. He raised girls. So I thought that might be a good set of expertise to help answer questions you guys might have. So as we're going through some of these things, be thinking of some of those questions. That was part of the idea. It's a workshop. It's designed to be that way so that there's question answer. I'm going to give you homework. It's not a completely inclusive session where I unload information and then we're done. It's a workshop setting. So again, the first part, I'll try to go through these principles, and then the latter part, questions and kind of a smorgasbord. About 3 years ago, a friend of mine came with me, a fellow named Daniel Andery. Daniel and I know each other from church, and he was telling me about when he was a kid that he had a love for airplanes, and he said he got his pilot's license when he was 16, with his dad sort of encouraging him. So when he was 16, he made a solo flight from Oklahoma City, somewhere here in Texas, I forget the town, but he didn't have a radio. So he had to land and then get on the ground, of course, call his dad, and then let him know he was okay. And I thought, man, here's a 16-year-old, put him in an airplane, he goes and navigates to a small airfield here in Texas, gets some gas, and then flies back home by himself. I just thought that was astounding. Maybe some of you guys have done that. Maybe you're pilots or know someone. But I just thought it was so impressive that here you could take a young man and teach him things, guide him, train him, and literally cut him loose to fly. I've just pictured that when it comes to our kids. I want to use that flight analogy a bit as we talk forward. And it's kind of interesting when we learn to drive, we're basically largely two dimensions. Well, excuse me, three. You know, left, right, forward, and back. Those axes. And I feel pretty secure when the ground's underneath me. In a boat, things are a little bit different. You still have forward, back, left, right, and you're kind of sliding the tides back and forth. But you're still in a single plane or level. You get into an airplane, you've got up and down. left, right, forward, back. Then you have wind that comes in different directions. You have to cock the plane. It's kind of like a boat, too, where you adjust it for the wind speed. The altitudes behave differently. And you have to learn, it's a lot more gooey than flying or than the driving. Depends on the weather conditions. If it's ice, it's, you know, hard to control. But flying is just a lot more, it takes a lot more skill, a lot more finesse. But in a way, we're trying to train our kids to that point where they can fly and handle those currents and not crash. So we'll try to apply that as we go forward. A story we're going to look at in the Old Testament regarding King David and Absalom. And this is 2 Samuel 12 and 13. That's where the story is told. I'm not going to read all of that, but I think most of you are familiar with it. What had happened is that one, of course, David had several wives and kids by the different wives. Amnon, one of the brothers, saw his half-sister Tamar. And just, I mean, she apparently it was just a pretty girl, and he just had this desire for her. And one of the cousins in that family, I think it was one of David's sister's sons, if I've got the guy right, but he was a cousin. And he went to Amnon and said, "So, why are you looking so bad?" And he said, "Well, I'm just in love with Tamar, and you know, I can't touch her." So this guy said, "I tell you what, why don't you pretend to be sick? And then when the king says, what's wrong, you just say, well, I'm just kind of sick. And I just wish I could have Tamar come and just cook some cakes for me." You know, so that was the setup. And I think you remember the story. While Tamar came to do the cakes, he said, run everybody out of here. And basically, he raped her there. And then after he raped her, then he sent her out. And said the hatred he had for her was greater than the love he had before. So he despised her. And he had these little conversations. I know there was a lot more, but Absalom said, "Has Amnon, my brother, been with you?" And he said, "Come and stay in my house, and I'll take care of you." And then it says, too, that what had happened was reported to David, and it displeased him. And he didn't do anything about it. And Absalom, over the next 2 years, basically set up a banquet and asked his dad, "If I could have all my brothers and sisters come to the banquet." So they all came, and then while he was there, he had some help and murdered his brother Amnon. And of course, all the young men and women, they ran like crazy. So people saw all these young men and women coming into town and knew something terrible had happened. And this cousin just happened to be in the throne room because it had been told David, I think they were saying stuff like, you know, all the kids have been killed or something like that. But Amnon said, "No, relax. Only Amnon is dead." Because this guy, he helped set it up. I mean, he knew what was going on. So Absalom fled from his father because he had murdered his brother. I mean, he should. And it was a couple of years. Joab, again, David's cousin, set it up to bring Absalom back after Absalom had acted out. So finally, David had Absalom come back to Jerusalem, but he didn't say anything to him, didn't see his face. So for a couple of years, Absalom was hanging around back in Jerusalem, but he was like, I should never be here because my dad won't even talk to me. So he got a bunch of foxes, and Joab wouldn't talk to him either. Absalom was trying to find some way to get to his dad. So he acted out and tied some foxes' tails together and put torches on them and turned them loose in Joab's field, you know, and burned it down. And Joab was displeased. So, but anyway, Absalom got Joab's attention, presented the situation, and Joab went back to David and finally kind of got them to talk to each other. Anyway, we know what happened even later. Absalom rose up against his own dad. And then, of course, his dad fled, and Absalom wound up being killed to protect David. So that story, I'm largely referencing work by Kevin Huggins, and this is in the resources. This is a book, and there's a tape study series, Parenting Adolescents by Kevin Huggins. He pointed out that in this sequence, there are three things that happen that parents do, and I'm guilty of all this. The first is denial. You know, David, I mean, good grief, the servants knew what was going on, and it was sort of the talk of the palace or the city. The other people knew what was going on, but David was sort of in denial about what had really happened with his kids. He was very, very displeased by it. He an experience of disappointment. Disappointment is when we have a desire that isn't met, or maybe met in the wrong way. So then we experience that. It's disappointment. Then a third thing that developed because of the way he dealt with the disappointment was distance. So in the ministries that Kevin Huggins develops at his church on teaching parents as far as parenting teens, he said there are three things that they really aim for. It's got a lot of skills in it too, but three things. One is to weaken layers of denial. Just peel that back and let the parents see how they're doing that and make it so it's not so easy. So when they're developing the ministry, they're do it in a way to weaken layers of denial. And then secondly, to create an atmosphere so it encourages parents to experience and then to deal with that disappointment and also the shame they feel as parents, especially of teens. And then thirdly, it challenges parents to repent or lay aside that commitment they've developed to maintain distance as parents. And a lot of this may sound like, that's just, you know, wacko, dysfunctional families, but this is very, very, very common. So we all have expectations. When they're not met, we experience disappointment. And when it comes to our family, you know, most of us are old enough, especially if you have teens, you've been married for a while, and we wind up experiencing disappointment with our kids, maybe with our wives too, because in some way there's some expectations that weren't met. Like, you know, they don't appreciate me, or, you know, I'm tired and they should have noticed. You know, just stuff like that. We have expectations. When they're not met, we experience disappointment. When it can occur with our kids, it's like, oh, you know, my kid embarrassed me on the football field and he flew off the handle and picked a fight, you know, with one of the other players and he was ejected from the game. And here I'm a deacon in the church, you know. How does that make me look? You know, so I'm experiencing disappointment because of my kids. Or they may get mouthy and not respect me as dad. And so I experience that disappointment. And, you know, Kevin Huggins pointed out just a principle in James 4, verse 1 and 2, where he said, where do conflicts come from in our lives? And James, by the way, this is the first written book in the New Testament. So, by Jesus' half-brother. Wouldn't you like to know what sibling rivalry would have been like? You know, James, half-brother, and Jude. These guys are both Jesus, raised up as Jesus' brothers, and here they've written parts in the New Testament. I mean, they came around because they called him Lord and God. So, but anyway, growing up, you wonder how that worked. So James 4:1, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures which wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. And then James, of course, he was talking about sin patterns here. In the sense of dealing with disappointments in an inappropriate way, that is in very much a source of conflict and problems in a family and in the relationship. And again, I'm going to reference him on several of these things. He pointed out that there are two models on parenting. And one he calls the consumer model. The other he calls it the ministry model. And in the consumer model, basically, it's what's in it for me. You know, for in this parenting relationship, what's in it for me? I am going to, when my kid hits the honor roll, I'm going to be able to stand up in class and tell my people at work, you know, my kids on the honor roll, or maybe how they behave in a group. I'm the leader of this ministry or here in church, and they're going to make me really look good, you know. And those are expectations we have. When the kid doesn't meet it, then we are threatened personally, and then we respond personally, whether it's words or other kinds of things. The a motto, if you were to assign a motto for the consumer model, it's nothing is to be gained by staying in a painful relationship if it doesn't benefit me. That's a consumer model. There's nothing to be gained by staying in a painful relationship if it doesn't benefit me. So if you're operating that way as a parent, not knowing it, then dealing with the disappointment inappropriately is going to result in a change in their relationship. You might be able to guess where that might go if that's the model. Then the ministry model, it takes a different approach. That what's most important in this relationship, myself and my teen, is the teen's growth, their relationship with the Lord. This is the most important thing here. And Ephesians 6:4, we are instructed to raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So that's the principle, the guiding principle in that relationship. I'm bringing them up in nurture and admonition of the Lord. So that's what's most important. Their need is more important than my need here. If this works out well, great. It'd be nice to hear about it. If it works out poorly, so that they're disappointing me, they're still my kid. I'm still their parent. And the most important thing teens or children and many adults need is protection from foolishness. Foolishness means what will make me truly happy is getting my own way. That is foolishness. And that's what's bound up in the heart of a child. And we need to help them to regurgitate that so that they can step out of foolishness. So the motto of the ministry model is, any amount of pain in a relationship is worth enduring if it will benefit another's relationship with Christ. Different model, different motto for these different ministry models in parenting. There's some verses to consider. In 2 Corinthians 13, verses 6 and 7, I believe this is in the New English Bible, it says, "Now I pray to God that you may do no wrong, not in order to show that we are a success, but that you may do what is right, even though we should appear to be failures." So that's the mindset. In this situation, my teen's growth is what's paramount. If I don't get credit, or if I'm discredited, or embarrassed by it, or my expectations aren't met, those are expendable. What's most important is that they do what's right, even though I might look not so good. And in 2 Corinthians 12:15, Paul, in the chapter before this, said, And I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. So he had that commitment that even if I'm not getting positive feedback or getting negative feedback, that the more and more I love you, I be loved less. He's still committed to hang in there with them. In 1 John 4:19, we have a model there. We love because he first loved us. So that's how we learn to love, not because we're so wonderful, but because someone chose to love us even when we didn't love them. Now, Kevin Huggins also mentions another model this is taught in their course in raising teens. The story of Samson, when he was conceived, or before he was conceived, an angel came to Manoah and his wife. Actually, came to his wife first and said, "You're going to have a son. Basically, you're going to raise him as a Nazarite," which was a particular lifestyle among the Jews. "And he's going to deliver my people." So Manoah came, and his wife said, "This man showed up and said, we're going to have a kid." And then so Manoah said, "Please send the man back." So God did send the angel back, and he asked them about this son. What will be his manner of work? You know, basically, how are we going to raise this kid? So then after he didn't get any more information, he invited the guy to stick around. He said, let's feed you and, you know, stick around. And so the angel did stick around for a while, and then he prepared the meal, and then the angel touched it, and it went up in fire, which was what happens with a sacrifice. When God accepts a sacrifice, it goes up in fire. And then the angel disappeared. And then Manoah, when he saw that, he said, Oh no, we're terrified. We've seen God. We're going to die. So Huggins pointed out there are some things here that sort of built around this scenario. Very often we as parents have this thing that we get this little baby, or especially the first 4 weeks, and it's like, okay, where are the instructions for this thing? And then as teens, it's like, oh, I've got this creature in my house. What do I do? And basically, Manoah was asking for a cookbook. You know, what do I do? Show me the instruction manual. And the angel refused to do it. He just reiterated what he said the first time. No cookbook. You know, here you go. He's Nazarite. He's going to deliver his people. And no cookbook. And the second thing, and again, this may have been a bit of a stretch, but the idea that, well, you're the one who told me about this. Can't you just stick around for a while? And almost like many times we want to do, like, well, we need a good youth director. You know, we need the right kind of music for the kids. And maybe if the kids are really struggling, it's like, well, you know, maybe we need some extra things. And, you know, maybe the Christian school will help them. And I did Christian school, by the way, so don't. I'm not picking anybody. Or maybe homeschool, or maybe this particular curriculum, or not, maybe not that, or just getting better friends, or something like that. And so the idea, you want to recruit somebody else, you know, to help you raise the kid. So the cookbook, and then the second, trying to find someone else who would do it for you. And then the third thing he pointed out is some role reversal. Just an interesting observation that Manoah, in this scenario, Manoah started to panic because he said, oh, we're going to die. We've seen God. And then his wife sort of stepped in and said, now relax. You know, if God wanted to kill us, he would have done it by now. You know, so what you have is kind of a role reversal where the wife sort of takes on the lead role and the guy takes on a dependent role. And whether or not this is really, you know, fast in Scripture, it's an observation that Huggins had mentioned that when men feel threatened, they tend to be more womanly in the marriage. And women, when they feel threatened, tend to be more manly. And the greater the threat, those greater those tendencies. Now, that's not universal, but, you know, I've seen that with us too. I mean, it's just kind of there. So it's something to be aware of, that role reversal. And what happens too when the parents are operating in that mode and nobody's really in their right role, guess who's in charge? Well, it's the kid. It gives the kid a chance to take on further role reversal and the kid to be in charge. There's a commercial. It's on a Thunder basketball, or as far as getting NBA tickets. And in it, the dad and the son are watching NBA basketball, and they see one of their family friends on shown in the stands. And the dad says, well, how did they get tickets? And the kid says, well, Dad, here's, you can get them on NBA.com and the tickets. And they're all never sold out. And then the dad says, oh, I'm glad we thought of that. And they charge her, we're going to the game. And then as the dad leaves the room, then the kid and the mom look at each other and grin to give a high five. Basically, you know, because dad walks out like he's in charge, but really it was the kid and the mom who were the smart ones. You know, so that pattern is a lot of what we're taught, you know, and we accept in our culture. But that role reversal is what we're seeing. So with those things in mind as well, those biblical stories, when it comes to flying, as far as also instrument flying, where things don't look easy, there's a pattern. Or it's been called induction. And basically what that is, it's giving reasons why following a set of rules is good for you. That's a principle we need to be using in helping our kids. There are rules. And to help them follow the rules, give them reasons why it's good for them to follow those rules. And that's just a pattern. We call it induction. That's strategy number one as far as instrument flying. You know, when you're up in the air and, you know, it's up, down, sideways, you know, twisting, how you fly. And if you can't use your eyes, you got to follow the instruments. You got to know how to fly it. So the second strategy is responding to defiance. And I think this is where a lot of us experience pain. At least I'm guessing with you guys, but it's that way in our house. When I'm dealing with defiance, it can be painful for mom and dad. It helps to understand a little bit about how teens think. And it may be that what's happening in the mind and the heart of our kid is that they are dealing with some kind of disappointment. Maybe they were made fun of. Maybe there's a friendship that was busted. A girl or a boy who didn't show them attention or went with somebody else, or somebody else got an award they didn't, or something. and or there, maybe there's something they're exploring. I mean, you know, we need to realize if our kids, if they don't know the Lord, they're pagans. And the idea, you know, that you can have one of the church elders have one of the kids being a pagan. I mean, you think that can't happen, but you know, if they haven't come to know the Lord, they're pagans. So the things that they're dealing with, they may know mom and dad won't go for them, and you confront it, they want distance. There's a thought that as our kids get to a certain age, you can't control them anymore, so you go with the flow. But really, there are, at least when it comes to influencing the lives of our teens, there are four things that, at least four things, that still give us some control. One of those is through admiration. Our kids do want to have to be or have some way where mom and dad admire them and look up to them and value them. They tend to behave, they can tend to behave in ways that, so that they capture mom and dad's admiration. Now, some kids can be overachievers in doing that because they're dealing with insecurities too, and they find out that's how they get mom and dad's admiration. But that's one way we have some influence. The second is through altering mental tapes. You know, I'm just so stupid, or I can't run straight, or I just have ugly eyes, or something, where there's just this tape they have in their heads. And we can help alter those mental tapes. And thirdly, through high levels of interaction. You know, if they're living in our house, then when they get sick, and they're thrown up all over the place, you know, mom, dad may show up, put a cool rag on their face, or help clean up their clothes and stuff. And their friends don't normally get in on that. When they're tired, or they're talkative, when they're moody, they're acting ways they don't want their kids to know, their friends to know, we're around that. So that exposure at least breeds influence. So that's a third way in which we have some influence, through high levels of interaction. And fourthly, through controlling their environment. You know, we still do have some control. You can't have the keys to the car. You know, your cell phone, I can have that turned off. You know, the other things, we have ways still, even though they're defiant, they're still dependent on us, you know, for a lot of those. So we still have some ways to control them. And basically, you know, if you don't like the rules, I'm sorry, but if you choose to break them, there's going to be some pain. I remember my kids, they learned at some point, so what are you going to do? And I really hadn't thought of anything. So I got to the point, it's like, I don't really know, but you're not going to like it. So flying through turbulence, it helps to know what's creating the distance. And it helps us, you know, what are you afraid of? What's threatening you in this situation? There was a point at which I thought I might lose this good relationship. And it didn't happen very often. Well, it just varied by the kid. But there were times when I thought, you know, my kids are not going to be happy with me. And, you know, my wife's probably not going to be very happy with me. But that's just it. I'm not going to have any friends at home. I'm going to make this decision. And I just really believe that's what we ought to do. And there are times when you're going to have to choose to not win the popularity contest because you know it's right. And kids can say things, especially preteens, teens, that their tongue is really sharp. And they may say things knowing it would hurt you, but it helped me to remember Proverbs 26:2, and it said, as a sparrow in its flitting and a bird in its flight, so a curse without a cause does not alight. So if they're hurling things at you, you know, you didn't deserve, you know they're not correct, a curse, well, it's not going to stick. It may not be pleasant, but it's not going to stick. And then Ecclesiastes 7:21-22, this is dealing with, you know, stuff you hear. And Solomon said, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart is known that even you have cursed others. So you may have to let some things roll off your back. And everything that's said, you may not, especially if you know in integrity it's not correct, then you can let that fly. If it is correct, you can have an opportunity to learn something about yourself. So courage to engage. Philippians 4:19 says, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And that's actually spoken in the context of finances, but it applies to other areas as well. And then 2 Corinthians 12:15, again, like we mentioned a minute ago, I will very gladly spend and be spent for you that the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. So the courage to walk into that. And you know, Jesus demonstrated that with the cross. Hebrews 12:2 says, "For the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame." He marched into something very, very unpleasant. But he did it knowing what was on the other side of it. So we need courage to engage. And it may be pretty scary and very unpleasant at times. So in dealing with the kids, they're in a situation where there needs to be some correction. Life may not be too cheery around the house, but something needs to be dealt with. There's a principle on rebuking, and this was a little item that was passed on to me some years ago. And this was a principle that the navigators had used. When you're dealing with a guy and he needs basically to be rebuked, be corrected, so how do you do that? And this was a principle of rebuke. So here are the things that are basically five things about it. Principles of rebuke. If I love a guy, I will rebuke him. But, one, rebuke is a two-way street. A, under that, I must be willing to commit myself to him. And B, he must be committed to me. You know, if that relationship's not there, it's probably not a good setting to enter that real tight thing of rebuke. Secondly, always rebuke on the basis of impression rather than fact. It's often tempting to say, well, you know, I heard what you said, and you did this and this and this and this. And you may not have been in on the rest of the conversation that led up to that, realizing it may have actually been the correct thing to do. So there are times when something may look like a sin or look like a mistake, and we just don't have the whole story. So the deal is, you know, Joey, I watched you going into the bar, and it didn't really look good. I mean, what was going on there? He said, well, you know, there's this guy from work. I've been witnessing to him, and he's getting, you know, and he just wanted to talk, and he wanted to have a beer, and I said, I'll just drink coffee, and he said, that's okay, so we'll go to the bar, his favorite place, and talk. So why would you rebuke a guy for that? So the thing is, the impression, Joey, you know, what I saw, it just looked like this. I mean, is that what was going on? So you rebuke on the basis of impression. If you have an impression something was going on, share it as an impression. Now, if it's obviously a transgression, you can hit it that way. But if you don't really know, approach it as an impression. That, and the same way with our kids. You know, I saw you doing this, and you know, it just looked to me like such and such. I mean, was that what was happening? And at least give them a chance to give you feedback before you jump on them. So, second, always rebuke on the basis of impression rather than fact. Third one, and this is in the context of disciple making, so that's the way it's built. So find out why he isn't doing it, a particular thing. There are two reasons. A, he doesn't see it. B, he's in rebellion. So again, find out what's going on. If it's something they truly have never been instructed on, give him the instruction. He just doesn't see it. If they fully know it and fully are aware of it, then they're in rebellion, and you deal with it as rebellion. Then the fourth thing, always rebuke from the Word of God. That is the basis of our authority. And then fifthly, have the person's best interests at heart. Do not have bitterness or anger in your heart. So those are principles of rebuke. Now, in dealing with kids or friends or others, there are times when we may completely have misread the situation and we're loaded for a bear and ready to just blow their guts out. But we may not have all the information. And one of the things, this came out of Growing Kids God's Way, dealing with younger kids, and it's how to make an appeal. And I've printed here for you what Gary and Ann Rizzo have in their book. This is from the Leader's Manual to describe the appeals process. So I'll let you read that. Basically, it means that if I've made a decision and the kid has a disagreement or simply knows that I don't have the whole story, then the thing is respectfully say, Dad, can I make an appeal? And this is not a whining session. It's not a complaining session. You know, those are not allowed. But it's gives the kid a chance to offer information we may not have had when we made the decision. Even my wife has used this 2 weeks ago. She said, now, Stan, can I make an appeal? And because I was getting ready to kind of blister one of my guys, you know. And she offered me some information that I didn't have, which cooled my jets. And then we listen, and the kid understands there's no guarantee that it'll change Dad's mind at all. But they have an opportunity to have some feedback. And in a polite manner, you know, with respect, may I make an appeal, understanding it's not a complaint, it's not a whining session. They get to offer information that I may not have had, and then they're still to accept whatever decision is made. It's helpful. That way the kids, especially if they know you're wrong and they're trying to find some nice way to say it, this gives them an opportunity to do that. So the following pages, these are scenarios. What we're trying to do is, again, learn how to fly. If you've been on a boat at night, you know there are these piers that have the green and red piers at night to tell you what's the shoreline, what's open ocean, and you can't see anything at all except those red and green signs, and you have to negotiate the boat in between them. Anywhere in between those two signs is fine. You got lots of room, but you got to be in between those puppies, or you may ground your boat. So what we're trying to do, these scenarios that we're trying to set those posts, and operating anywhere in between those is where you want to be. You don't want to get outside them. So here is one. On one hand, the left hand, it says, it did not restrain them. On the right hand, do not exasperate them. Then in the middle, keep them under control with all dignity. Now, Eli, later Samuel, Eli brought a curse on Israel, basically because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and Eli did not restrain them. And that's why God punished Israel. On the other hand, so we're to restrain our kids appropriately. On the other hand, the idea is don't exasperate them. And you by exasperating, you it's like you never give them a chance to win. The rules change. They can't ever win. And they get exasperated. In the middle is clear expectations, consistent consequences. Ecclesiastes 8:11 says, where no sentence is speedily executed upon the criminal, there the heart of man is given in them to do evil. So there's something about just appropriate and timely discipline. And then Ephesians 6:4, to raise them in the discipline and admonition of the Lord. So that's the idea of keeping them under control with all dignity, which is a mark of a deacon or an elder. And then the next page, you can see other on the left hand, the child wins. On the right hand, the parent wins. And I asked my wife, Dottie, what she would think I should tell you guys as far as raising teens. And she said, one sentence, she said, pick your battles carefully. Okay. So that's where we are. Pick your battles carefully. You know, our kids, when they're young or older, their tantrums may threaten some. They may manipulate a guilt trip like, you don't love me or you don't want me to have any fun and stuff like that. On the other hand, when you do win, you've won the battle, you know, that's not the time to rub it in, trash talk. It's not time to do that. And there may be times when you can diffuse a battle by finding something where both people win. So you want to be as creative as you can to deflect a battle. Next page, on the left hand, there's the idea of being passive, and then on the right hand, being overbearing. You want to be in the middle, and the responsibility is to take, or the middle is to take responsibility. 1 Peter 5, 3 and 4 says, the elders among you shepherd the flock of God which is among you, not by constraint, but willingly. So it really is on our shoulders to step up, take responsibility. A lot of times it's easy. Kent and I were talking earlier, in fact, about, you know, our wives, and a lot of times, you know, it's easier just to let our wives just kind of, you know, take it and run with it, especially when the kids are little. But it still is on us to step up and take responsibility for shepherding the family. And our culture tells us, like that commercial, that men are wimpy, they're not real smart, you know, and really the women are the ones who are smart, and the kids really haven't figured out. And there's just in our culture, we're told that we're just inadequate, you know. So the temptation is just to say, okay, I'll just let my wife do it, because she does the kid stuff and I do the work stuff. And that's the role reversal. So, and our wives are often longing for us to step up and take the weight so they don't have to do it. Then on the other hand, the other extreme from being passive is being overbearing. Proverbs 28:16 says, a ruler who is a great oppressor lacks understanding. If we're dominating, overpowering our kids. We're not getting it. That shows a lack of understanding on our part. Tough love is real and needs to be used, but we're not talking about being oppressive, being too tough for the sake of toughness. The goal is to train them, not just to beat them up. Then on the next page, on one hand is foe, the other extreme is friend. And the middle of that is father. And kids, there may come time when the teen says, "I hate you." And I remember going through some of that. But one of the responses would be, "Well, you know, if I were in your situation, I would hate me too. You know, I don't blame you." And things like, "Well, you don't want me to be happy," and all that stuff. And so the situation you could apply it to. But I remember saying, "Well, I'm not your friend, I'm your father." And I said, "You want to know what your mom and I talk about at night when we're in bed? We're talking about ways to make your lives miserable." You know. So anyway, they quit pulling that chain when I told them I wouldn't let them have any fun. It's like, "No, I'm your dad." Then on the other side of that is being a friend. You know, that's where you give in to demands just to keep the peace. You know, the kid's acting out, making all kinds of scenes, acting up at school. So let's just kind of back off and let them have their way, and things will settle down. And they probably will, because the kid figures out, yeah, if I kind of back off, then mom and dad back off. So that results in distance. Trying to be the friend, you know, create some distance so there's no blow up. On the other hand, the teen creates conflict because he knows it gets mom and dad to back off. So the teen uses conflict to create distance. What you have is that distance on either side. You know, again, what we talked about in the beginning, denial, disappointment, and distance. And then you have that environment of distance. Well, the dad, this is Proverbs 13:24. "He who spares his rod hates his son." That's distance. And the kid knows that. "But he who loves him seeks him diligently with discipline." So our job as dads is to close the distance. And it can be very unpleasant. Other times can be really neat. I mean, kids, this is largely negative stuff. But kids, teens are a lot of fun. And, you know, on the next page, it's create conflict, avoid conflict. In the middle, use conflict. So you can grow, and so they can grow. And in Jeremiah 6:14, it's interesting that God condemned some of the leaders. "They have healed the hurt of my people slightly or superficially, saying, 'Peace, peace,' when there is no peace." So we want to be careful about just healing things superficially. That's kind of the run-through. The next few minutes, we've got about 20 minutes or so, and you guys get to ask questions. I'm going to call Stuart, if that's all right. Can I do that, guy? Is that all right? The resources, this next, are you familiar with the book The Blessing by Gary Smalley? I've summarized the book for you on this handout about blessing.
Hello, bro.
Hey, Stu. We got some guys here who are interested in hearing what you have to say. Say hi to Stu, guys. Yeah, let's say hi. Well, I was telling them that I raised boys, and you have raised three delightful young ladies.
Okay.
So you had some tips that we talked about.
What
was it? Yeah, well, you had some tips on raising girls. You had some real short tips. Remember, we talked about those. How about if you tell the guys that, and then I'll have them ask some questions.
Dance with girls.
Dance with girls.
Have all the guys who just have girls stand up.
Or anybody who had just all girls? Stand up, stand up. Stand up. He says stand up. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, they're standing.
Just have girls.
Just have girls.
Okay, have them put their hands on their belts like they're Superman.
All right.
No,
you
doing
like
it with
like
them?
Superman. Yeah, they're the okay, they've got the pose.
Okay, guys, you're the girls' heroes. You are the hero. And once you stand there and think about it, when there's bugs that need to be killed, you're the man to kill them. When there are hurts that need to be fixed, if mom beats you to it, that's okay. But if you're there, you're the one to do it. Okay, another thing, I want you to take your right hand and press forward like you're saying stop.
Okay.
Okay, You know, not only are you the Superman, but you're there to stop things from causing their daughters hurt. You're it. You're the person who stands in the gap. Then the last one, put your arms around like you're hugging someone because you're the hug daughter needs more than any other man in their life until they meet their husband. So when you do that stance right there, remember that you are the guy that's keeping these young ladies safe from any hairy-legged old boy, as our Papa Tommy used to say. Okay, they can sit down now.
Okay, great, thanks. Thanks. Now the guys might have some... Okay, go for it.
Again? Did you go over the basics of what we... Let me just go over the basics that I was talking to you about.
Well, we've gone through the first half about dealing with disappointment and those kinds of things, so we're done with that. And you had some other thoughts, I think, about the girls?
Let me just give them the basic rules that I talked to you about, and I think that might take care of it.
All right.
One of the things I would never let my daughters get away with was to embarrass my wife in public. That's a rule that they have no option. They have to follow that. And when they broke that one, that's when I took in the nuclear option. And I told you about my mini escapades with our daughters with that.
Put all the toys in the closet for a month or something?
I put them up in the attic and they stayed there till we sold the house. And my daughter never got the toys back.
Oh boy.
So you can tell them about that.
You just did.
Oh. let me find my...
They may have some questions for you in just a minute. There are some other guys who have daughters and stuff. So they get to ask you those tough questions.
Another thing, and you'll probably talk about it, back me up, is delayed gratification.
No, talk about that.
Okay, well, there are three things you can do that make your kids become juvenile delinquents. That's easy money, free time, and free transportation. And if you take any one of those away, they understand the term delayed gratification. First of all, they have to pay for their transportation. They have to have a job. That does away with free time. If they want to buy stuff that's beyond their basic needs, like a special pair of shoes or whatever that's beyond what you would normally spend, then they have to do it with their own money. This delayed gratification, they appreciate what they buy. And when they earn it, they appreciate it even more. Now, at the same time, being the dad and having my daughters wrap me around their finger, when they were there to lay the money down, there was multiple times where I would pull their money back and pay for it myself. But they had to have the money themselves. And that's a real important part. Another thing is in the area of affection. Some guys have a hard time with this. Some of us are different. But with me, a day did not go by that I did not tell my daughters I love them. Not a day. Not a conversation. It was just like your dad, like our dad was with us. Not a day went by. And I never, ever kissed my girls on the lips. I tell them that's reserved for their husband. And remember, Stan, I was telling you about how Laura called me a month before she got married asking permission to kiss her now husband. And I thought she was crazy, but yes, she waited until a month before. She was waiting, wanted to get married on her wedding day, but didn't do it. She decided she couldn't stand it. She wanted to kiss him, so I told him to go ahead. And that's a very special thing. That protects your daughters from looking for someone else to fill your role. And the only time some young man comes in between, takes on your role, is when they become their husband. Other than that, you're the one responsible. And then another thing, guys, I love this one. You got to take them shopping. It's real important to them to know that you care enough that you're going shopping with them. And you can point out things you don't like about clothes. And then the other thing I think that my daughters look back on, which I'm going to see them in March in D.C., and one of them has already planned a date, and that's a daddy-daughter date. You teach your daughters how they expect to be treated on a date. And what we did is on their birthdays, we took them out on a date, or I did, and they could have company with us, or they could just go with me. But it was their choice, and it was just their time. So that's the big things that I would, if I had a chance to tell everybody, that's the big things to do.
Go Beans, thanks. Guys, do you have any questions for Stu about raising girls, girl teens? Yes, Mike.
So, Stu, how did you encourage them to draw close to the Lord and walk with God in on their own, where it was their own desire to meet with God and desire to walk in His ways? What did you do to encourage that? What did you see that worked? Maybe you did. And what did you do, or what did you see that didn't work?
Yeah, let me repeat the question.
I heard.
Well, but
you did
but
make it work.
Yeah, but I want to do it for the tape. I want to do it for the tape. What did you do to encourage the girls in their own walk relationship with the Lord? What worked and what didn't?
Well, I'll tell you the most important thing is, in as far as the spiritual life of my daughters, is my wife, because they always will mimic us. And there wasn't a day that didn't go by that my daughters did not see my wife praying or reading her Bible. It was part of our life. And what you practice in front of them is what they accept. So whatever you are doing in your own life is what they will do.
Okay.
That's just,
cool beans. Any other questions? I'm going to keep you on the line, Stu.
I will say this, is there are times where my daughters had called and had a real tough day, and they want you to pray for them and with them. And when they see that you're human and you make mistakes, it really makes a big difference to them. But praying with them is another thing, too, that's very, very important, even now.
Cool.
As my daughters are all in their 20s. Nope, one's in the 30s.
Well, Stu, I want you to hang on. I'm going to make some other comments here, and you might have some other thoughts, and
sure.
You guys might, too, as well. So one of the other things, too, is I'm going to be talking, so don't go away. One of the things, if you want to know what's going on with your kids and their friends, volunteer to drive carpool. It may not seem like a lot of fun listening to the children's chatter. It amazed me the kinds of things they would start talking when I was keeping my mouth shut just driving. They would start telling little personal things. And I'm thinking, I can't believe they're talking about this. I'm in the car. But just that, if you want to know what's going on, get a pulse, volunteer to drive those carpools. You know, sports events, school, whatever. And you don't have to entertain them. I mean, just you're just a bug on the wall. And, you know, one of the things that was a help to us, and it's a cultural thing, church life, I think it's still is important to have the kids involved in church life, because you have sort of spiritual cousins and others, and there's still a family atmosphere there, and kids carry that forward, remembering that kind of a hometown a family event, a church life. And part of that, too, we need to be careful about complaining. You know, if our kids listen to us say things like, "Did you hear what the preacher said? You know, I can't believe that. And here, you look what they're doing with the money and this kind of carpet." Now, it's one thing to talk through disagreement and process stuff, but when we convey to the kids that this church or the pastor is an incompoop or is somehow dishonest or whatever, and they listen to us, then the kids are processing. And it's like, well, I don't want to ever be a part of that. And the kids will, and sometimes we might actually be truly offended. The kids are watching. How does mom, how does dad process that they've been hurt? How are they processing that? And the kids can, even though they're little bitty kids, may step up and take up an offense for mom and dad and want to do battle for mom and dad, get mad at the other people. So we've got to be cautious, careful about how we present that as a family. Are we complaining? Is that something we do about spiritual leaders or whatever, or a church? In our kids, they need to see us process emotion. We do experience disappointment. We experience anger. We experience joy. We experience grief. We experience fear. We experience anxiety. And our kids are looking to us because they experience that stuff, and they're wondering, how do I process this? And dealing with relationships. So they need to see us forgive. They need to see us ask forgiveness. It may seem kind of tough. I've had to do it with my kids. And I remember, especially one time with my middle son, I thought, I've broken something of his. I did something while really was clearly wrong. And I thought, okay, if I go to my kid and say, I was wrong, will you forgive me? Then I'm setting myself up because I'm not in charge. I'm not, the big guy. And I was amazed. What I didn't hear this stuff of unloading a truck of resentments and stuff. He said, oh, that's okay, Dad. And he was all right with it. Really surprised me. So demonstrating that to our kids is a big part of developing that relationship when we're training them for life. And helping them learn to discern and face danger. One of the draws for amusement parks, the roller coasters, things like going to the zoo or camping, there are dangers there. And camping, there are noises that go boo or bump in the night. And there's something about the kids that they want to learn how to deal with danger. And there are ways we can introduce them to danger in a safe way, not be foolish about it, but that's one of our tasks, to help them learn how to deal with danger and then trust God. Where it gets to be really difficult is where it's a situation where I can't rescue them. Then I have to trust God. So look who's in the hot seat there as far as relationship with the Lord. I'm trusting Him to do what I can. You still there, Stu? Did I lose you?
Oh, yeah, I'm just remembering the time where you were going to go kill the bear with your fingers when we were robbers at Romano State Park.
Yeah, I wasn't.
You had no fear. you got off three shots before you realized you weren't doing any good. Anyway.
I guess Mom grabbed me and pulled me back into the cabin. Oh, boy. Also, guys, we need to be careful about complaining about our spouse or about the other kids. There's a tendency, this is the deal of being the consumer, where I'm using the kid for my emotional needs, and maybe our wife has said something or didn't, meet our needs, so we kind of pull the kid aside and say, well, your mom, da-da-da-da-da-da. Or the wives can do the same thing about dads. And we pull the kid and make the kid basically the big brother, when the kid wants to be the kid. And we're using them for our own emotional support. And it doesn't help their security, and there are ways, again, to deal with disagreements. But when we're using our kids for our emotional support, then they've lost dad or lost mom. We've got a big brother, a little brother, So we want to be careful about complaining about our spouses. And then also, you've probably heard this about comparing them with each other. I remember this conversation too. I have three sons. They're different. My oldest is really gregarious. He's a writer. He loves debate. He does it for sport. Even if he's not right, he knows that he'll just debate something just for the sport of it. My middle son is very, very much an introvert. He knows he's trying to develop things socially. He knows it's hard for him, but he's a craftsman, just amazing. And my youngest son is very much an introvert. I think David's coming tonight, and he loves music and gizmos. But relationships is just hard for him. So the guys are all different. And I remember one time the middle son, John, he was doing something or whatever. And my oldest didn't like the way we were dealing with him. And so James, the oldest, he said, well, you know, you didn't do that with John. So I, knowing that they were different, I said, well, do you want me to treat you like I treat John? And he thought about it and he said, no. Because you have to deal with them differently. But when you compare and say, well, why can't you be an A student like your big brother? You're setting them up to be exasperated. If it's something they truly have no control over, then you're going to exasperate them because you set them up so they cannot win. So you want to be very careful about that.
Yeah, plus kids really need to win. They have to know that their dad, their parents are so proud of them that they have a chance to win and a chance to get that pat on the head.
Yeah.
That's very important, so amen on that.
We got a couple of 3 minutes, guys. Other questions? Surely you have some since you're at this workshop. Yes, Mike. Okay, here's the question, Stu. What about the situation where the mom and the teen are in conflict and mom's half wrong? So how do you handle that? Between the mother and the teen, and the mother actually is partly in the wrong.
I will honestly say that in all my life, my wife has never, ever been wrong. And she's in the room with me.
I've got this on tape, dude. You're in good shape, man.
I know. We have found that it is so much easier to just be honest up front, and if we screw up, we screw up. My wife is one who will apologize and will never let a hurt go. Me on the other side, I've been trained well, been raised up in a locker room, and I'm not easy to say, will you forgive me, but it does happen. You have to do it because kids remember it. I mean, my daughters remember every time I said I was sorry. So, yeah, that's...
Let's brainstorm this one a bit, because, I mean, you guys have that wired. If there were a situation, of course, this is hypothetical, that you're going to have to convince both the mom and the teen that both of them are at fault.
Okay.
What do you think?
If there's one where the mom doesn't realize that she's at fault or refuses to accept it, that's where you send the teen away, and you've got to talk with her, and you two have to get on the same page. If you're not on the same page, you're done.
Oh, so you're saying don't deal with her in front of the teen.
No. Okay. You have to be on the same page, and your hearts have to be together before you can go to a teen and make a correction.
Yeah.
You can't do that with a kiddo in front of them.
By the way, guys, Stuart was a supervisor at the post office for over 20, how many years?
30
years. So he's dealt with a bunch of situations. Well, good. We got about another minute or so, Stu. The guys, there are some other resources that are here in the handout. One is Parenting Today's Adolescent by Dennis and Barbara Rainey. If you're familiar with A Weekend to Remember, they're the ones who've pioneered that. This is their ministry. And then Paul Tripp has a couple of books, The Age of Opportunity, and then Parenting, 14 Gospel Principles That Can Radically Change Your Family. And these, again, what we've done, we've not done a lot of the mechanics today. I've tried to really emphasize the principles. And this book is a counter. It's the other half of lots of techniques. It's the gospel principles that undergird all that. And like Kevin Huggins mentioned, the idea is to have you operate between the lines. And I remember there was a plane crash in Iowa. This has been maybe 12 years or so. And a large commercial jet crashed in a field in Iowa. And what had happened is that they found out later one of the blades from an auxiliary engine had flown loose and cut through the tailpiece, and it disabled their ability to navigate the plane. And in the process of trying to manage that, the cockpit had the pilots talking to each other, and the co-pilot was looking through the manual, and he said, there's not a procedure for this. what do we do? Apparently they rehearsed all these things, and they said, well, there's not a procedure for this. So what do we do? So they were there doing everything they had as far as the rule book, and they were caught having to manage a situation there was no guidance for. So they had to figure it out. That's the reason behind principles. So when you're caught there in that situation where the rule, where the user manual doesn't give you the answer, using the principles, you can navigate through that. Discipleshiplibrary.com. I think I showed you that before. That's the back page. I've listed for you, these are some of the talks that are available to listen to. I've listened to probably most of these since the summer to get prepared for this talk. And this is where, of all these, I thought the Kevin Huggins material was probably the best. There are other resources too. Focus on the Family. There are like 75 articles there on dealing with teens. So there's some great, great resources as far as, you know, managing teens. So we are out of time. Stu, bro, thanks for helping us out.
Hey, I will add one thing, Stan,
yes,
if you don't mind.
That's it.
There are the guys who have faced a divorce and don't have their daughters with them, but they're with their mother. These guys need to work even harder to let their daughters know that they love them, because that will keep their daughters from having to go through the same thing they did.
Yeah.
You are protecting their marriage by being a great dad. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
You should always tell them that they love them, they care for them. It has to be done. You can't miss that, especially if they're not with you. And I have a friend who's in that position that I spent several hours working with him on that. And he's got a real good relationship with his daughters.
Yeah.
It's very, very important.
And the challenge is closing that distance.
That's just
that we talked about. Well, good. Thanks, bro. I'm going to pray and then we're going to be done. So let me pray. Father, thank you for the children you've given us. God, we trust you will give us wisdom beyond our years and beyond our abilities, so that those young men and women can be drawn close to you and be successful in not only their relationship with you, but also their spouses and their own kids. And we commit this to you in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks, bro. Bye.